Storytelling is at the heart of political campaigns. Today's guest has studied those stories as part of a four-decade career in American politics. He's John Martilla, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we try to make sense of the stories shaping American public life. This week, we're joined by John Martilla, president of Martilla Strategies. He's a veteran political strategist who has worked on campaigns at every level of American politics, from the local to the presidential, including ballot initiatives. John, thanks so much for being with us. So let's take a moment and talk about the first 8 months of the Trump presidency. From your perspective, what have been the highlights? What have been some of the lowlights?
Well, I think that he has slowly, steadily, systematically turned American voters away from him. The most recent spate of poll results are not good. They're all under 40. I think there was a Gallup poll that came out past couple days, 33, 34. These are serious numbers, very negative numbers. So regardless of what he thinks about how he's performing, Americans are not approving of him. Now, having said that, I think that within the Republican Party itself and among self-identified Republicans, there's more support there. In fact, 50% in a recent survey said that if he wanted to postpone running in 2020, they would go along with it.
Yeah,
which shows how nuts they can be.
What does this foretell? I mean, it's we're talking a year and 15 months to 2018, which is a lifetime in politics.
Right.
We know that, but what can we glean from the numbers as they look now, as we look into our crystal ball at 2018 and even 2020? Is there a Democratic wave coming?
Well, in 2018, it's a very heavily slate of Democratic candidates, so that's problem number one.
So they've got to hold more.
They have to hold more. However, with his poll results under 40, if they do not improve, that would signal a pretty big revolution. Mm-hmm. I think for the first time, I believe Dems could get control of the House, even though the gerrymandering of the seats leans Republican. I don't want to sound like a totally anti-Republican, but I think that independent analysts who have looked at it believe that's the case. So I think it's too early to tell, but the Democrats have really got a tough road to hoe before next November. Mm.
So break it down for us. You're talking about the numbers. The approval rating has declined since he was inaugurated in January with the general public. Disapproval has gone up. What are the factors behind both of those trends?
Well, I think that his bellicose attitude, I think Americans hate the idea of the Twitters, his willingness to get into fights all the time. I mean, it's remarkable to me. The exchange with the North Korea this past week was just exceedingly reckless. And I think that some of the most sober voices on the Republican side, forget the Democrats, they were all opposed to it, have criticized him for this. And I think that it'd be good for the country if he stopped tweeting. I don't think that's going to happen. I think he's perfectly content doing this. He may have done it this morning or yesterday morning or on a new, with the business leaders pulling out of the committee. Three or four business leaders pulled out of the of his economic advisory committee, and they did so because of what he did last week in North Carolina.
Didn't voters, though, in last year in 2016, couldn't they realize or understood that he was what you're describing?
Well,
bellicose,
I think,
to use your word, and
not enough understood for sure. And I think the Democratic Party and Hillary's campaign left something to be desired. I just finished reading the book on the campaign, which pointed out that in Wisconsin and in Michigan, there was no normal polling in the last 5 or 6 weeks. These are states which were dead heats. I mean, I can't imagine that you would take those states for granted. But I think it was a little bit too much of young smart guys overreaching. I think you need to blend. There's always new political techniques that are being developed and practiced and so forth. But you can't walk away from some of the fundamentals that have guided American politics for the past 40, 50 years.
Do you, when you look at the numbers, the sort of the relative firmness of Republican support for the president when independents and Democrats he never had, but he's hemorrhaged right. independents. But Republicans have stayed true, still north of 70% in the most recent Gallup data. Republicans approve of the president's support, where you know it's sort of the inverse of the overall national numbers.
Right.
What does that tell us about both the partisanship and the partisan environment we're operating in? But also, does it also explain why this president hasn't moderated? Because his base is still with him.
His base is still with him for sure, 100%. And I think that helps explain why he has not moderated his views more. In fact, I think on several occasions, including this past weekend with the alt-right and all this stuff, I think he was so slow to move because of he was trying to talk to his base in a certain way. And I think that Republicans historically have been much more unlikely to criticize their party leader. In fact, I was just telling you that I read a recent book, an old book, which I read again, about the McCarthy era in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and the Republicans did not criticize him until the very last moments.
Yeah.
They stayed with him. And I think that, unlike Democrats who seem to like attacking or feeding on their own, Republicans are much more loyal.
Mm-hmm. The question is constantly posed, does that base at some point reach a tipping point and say, no more, no longer?
Well,
how would you answer that question?
I think it's mounting, for sure.
Yeah.
There are voices out there who we need as a country, McCain, I think, Lindsey Graham. They seem to take two steps forward and one step back, but they're moving in the right direction, I think. And I think that, I thought Hatch's statement about what he said about the showdown this past weekend in Charleston was appropriate, about his brother serving in World War II. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a tough moment for America.
Yeah.
And I think that it'd be great if he was not so prone to lighting fires all the time.
So let me try I hope it's not Pollyanna-ish, but an optimistic take on things. That what we saw in Charlottesville this past weekend was so reprehensible and so offensive to so many people, left, right, and center, that this is maybe the first time in a couple of years where Democrats and Republicans in large numbers were in the same place on their own, because this is fundamentally, you and I have talked over the years about, you know, fundamentally it's about values, what's in your gut. And is it possible that Charlottesville becomes a moment where Democrats and Republicans say, wait a minute, you know, we might disagree about the way we deliver health care, but we can agree on certain values that are going to shape policy solutions? Or am I just being overly optimistic?
I think the jury's still out on it, really, I do. I mean, I was heartened by Hatch. Mm-hmm. Hatch is really a conservative mm-hmm. Republican. And so him coming out and talking about his brother's service and all of that, I thought that was really terrific. But it's a very, very slow-moving train in terms of diminishing support. And Trump, he comes and goes in terms of whether he wants the support of the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. It's a truly remarkable moment.
I think the symbolism of Charlottesville was not unique, but for many people was, and I can't think of the exact right term, eye-opening. When you see a Nazi flag being carried by an American on American soil in support of their cause, I think some people went, whoa, And so I'd like your reaction to that. I mean, that's not something you see in the news every day.
No, I know.
I mean, this obviously harkens to Hitler.
I think we're talking about two stories here. One is that the people who sparked the neo-Nazis, yeah, who sparked all this, seem to be emboldened by what's happened, that they believe that they can continue to mobilize people across the country to demonstrate on or march on their behalf. I think there's all, but fortunately, there's a larger cohort of Americans, much larger, Democrats, independents, and Republicans, who will oppose them. But I don't know. I think they're around to stay, really.
Did you see this coming? Was there anything in any of the polling data that said there's a white nationalist movement that's going to be vocal and public and have political consequences in the last, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, in 2016, we conducted a national survey for the Anti-Defamation League during the final weeks of the presidential campaign. It was on a different topic. But we threw in a couple of questions about ADL has been an outspoken critic of these neo-Nazi organizations, mm-hmm, and so forth. But we did have one question in there, a couple of questions there about immigration policy. And a majority of Americans supported sending the 11 million illegals home to their original country before they could get being. And it was just a shocking, the questions were very fairly worded. Yeah. And I assumed it would be, 35, 65 our way, mm-hmm, in terms of, but it was not. So there's something going on out there that's underneath the surface that is really riling these forces up. And I think that helps explain Trump's victory for, mm-hmm, sure.
Do you see more confrontations like what happened in Charlottesville?
I think the alt-right and the neo-Nazis will be more careful about what they do. I hope that what happened here is that they broke the agreement. The agreement was, I didn't know this until a few days ago, that they were supposed to come through the city in a certain section of the city, mm-hmm, and they went a different route. They went a route that was more meant to kind of expose people, yeah, to each other. So I think that, I think the jury's out. I don't know. They certainly didn't look like they took body blows. I mean, their public statements this week have been pretty awful.
No, if anything, they've seemed to have been
emboldened.
Right. And yeah, right. So one quick related question to that. Do you think the governor's response in Virginia to declare a state of emergency was the correct response? That's been criticized by some as an overreaction.
There were 1,000 police, and I guess the state of emergency was an appropriate response, especially, I mean, not looking back. I mean, if they had intelligence that said the original routes were going to be bypassed, then I think it was appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're produced each week by a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS in Providence, Rhode Island. An audio version of the show can be heard 3 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States, the POTUS Channel 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Virginia University, inviting you to follow me on Twitter at JM Lutis. Next to me in the co-host chair is G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. He's an award-winning journalist, and you can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week, a friend of mine for the last 15 years, veteran political strategist John Martilla. John, so one of the myths, and I'm going to call it a myth, you can tell me if it's not, but one of the myths that seemed to emerge from 2016 was that battleground polling proved inaccurate, that Trump's victory came out of nowhere. Now, I look at that at some of those battleground states in particular and know that his victory is actually within the margin of error of the last polls that were run. Are polls still accurate in this day and age of cell phones and people living off the grid?
I think the best polling companies get it right. Mm-hmm. It's not a game for amateurs. It's more tricky all the time. The cell phone rate now in our surveys is 35% to 40%, okay, always. And that's tough. That scares you a little bit. But I think the big mistake, the book I mentioned earlier was called Shattered. And it took a look at what the Hillary Clinton campaign did, a campaign that had $1 billion, therefore they could do anything they wanted to do. They did not do any kind of traditional polling in Wisconsin or Michigan during the last 4 or 5 weeks.
It seems incredible.
It seems incredible. It's extraordinary.
Why do you think they didn't? I mean, it does seem incredible and extraordinary.
Well, I think that the campaign was taken over, I want to say this carefully, by a bunch of young, not so young, technology wise guys who I think discounted the importance of survey research. I'm not adverse to all the new fancy, newfangled techniques. In fact, I think I helped originate some of them. But good old-fashioned polling still serves its purpose. And I think that the postmortem on all the polling, all the best polling, is that it was within the margin of error. Now, I think Donald Trump came into election night, personally, the stories are that he didn't expect to win.
Yeah.
And then what happened in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was not as close. Pennsylvania, I think, was 6 or 7 points. Michigan and Wisconsin were clearly very close.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan was 12,000 votes.
That's right.
So, I think that, our pal John Kerry, when he ran for the Senate against the former governor Bill Weld in Massachusetts, this was 1996. That's 20 years. But nevertheless, we took 2 polls a week for the last 8 weeks.
In the Senate race. Yeah.
And so, for a presidential campaign, I cannot imagine not doing weekly, biweekly tracking polls. Yeah. It's just nuts.
With $1 billion, no less.
Right.
So we live in an era when a lot of people cry fake news, and we don't believe this and don't believe that. And part of that you and cry is polls don't mean anything, look what happened, blah, blah, blah. How do you respond to that? I mean, I happen to agree that polls remain valid and the best polling companies pretty much always get it right. But how do you respond to that, like, whatever?
Well, I think that
fake polls.
I mean, the best companies, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post, I think their polling does pretty good. I think my personal highest praise would go to the Wall Street Journal, which is done by a Democratic and Republican company, Peter Hart for the Dems, and Market Opinion Research for the Republicans. And they do consistently really excellent work. New York Times does great work. The Post is a little, they do excellent work. And the reporting right now that's coming out of the Post and the Times is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, it's not fake news. I mean, we're at a real pivotal moment in our country when hopefully some of these issues will be put to bed finally again.
So one
That's
of
the hope.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the issues that the country has been facing. So the White House wants people to believe that, or the story that the White House is pushing, is that Republicans had 7 years to say repeal and replace, repeal and replace. Now they need to repeal and replace. Is that an effective message?
No, I think that, in all the research I've done, which I've done a lot of research on the Affordable Care Act, Americans initially, they started off, first blush, good idea, by 10 points or so. And then gradually, the Republicans had a very unified voice. They pounded it relentlessly. Democrats didn't know how to handle that situation, in my view, and gradually diminished. But over time, as the fruits of the legislation began to be felt, Americans began to embrace it. And I think that repeal and replace, I just don't believe it can happen anymore. I think repeal or improve the Affordable Care Act can certainly happen. I think Obama would be for that. But if Trump continues his attack on the Affordable Care Act by cutting off funds, by cutting off allocations of, targeted resources, mm-hmm. and so forth, that could be serious. Mm-hmm. Could be serious.
What is your sense from what you've read in the polls you've read, and there hasn't been a lot yet on this particular issue, but regarding where the American people stand on the possible use of force against North Korea? We've had headlines that the president made talking about fire and fury and locked and loaded, and there was a lot of braggadocio, for lack of a better word, and there were some gung-ho people who I was listening to talk radio on one of those days, and it was like I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Yeah, well, yeah, let's nuke them, you know. But I think that those are outlying voices. I'm sorry that if I did that. But it sort of amazed me that, yeah, let's nuke them. Like, hello, can we think past what happens once we nuke them and Seoul, North Korea is gone and Japan's? Anyway, where do you think the American people are now on that issue?
I think a majority of Americans would oppose the attacks that Trump has been espousing. But I believe that there's a tendency, you know, we've done a lot of foreign policy polling, and there's kind of a tendency to lean towards kind of hawkish approaches. I have no doubt that if an attack were to take place, and if there were the casualties that people are talking about in Seoul and South Korea, that people would think it would be a horrifying mistake. But this is a really complicated and very, very tough problem.
There's something, too, about the American public in responding to the perception of threat, whether the threat is real or not. Right? There's a rally to the flag sort of response. And we saw that, I think, in spades after 9/11, and even in the run-up to the Iraq War, where there are a lot of sort of subject matter experts saying, slow down a little bit, because this is not as dire as you think it is, but a constant, steady, frankly, politically bipartisan drumbeat of the need to oust Saddam completely swamped any voices of dissent.
I agree. And then gradually, over time, Americans kind of turned against the Iraq War, for sure. The problem with North Korea and South Korea is that I'm heartened by the fact that both Trump and the Prime Minister of North Korea came out in the past day or so with more soft messages. But I believe that, attitudes, let's be the tough guy on the block and so forth. I don't know, there might be too many Americans who support that idea. The problem is that this war will be over in a day.
Yeah.
And the consequences of the war will be visible in a day.
Right.
So the lead up has no real impact upon the consequences. The consequences will be catastrophic.
Do you have any sense that behind the very strong words from Kim Jong-un and President Trump, there was actually diplomacy going on, that perhaps that wasn't necessarily a facade or a smokescreen, but was, for a certain public consumption for their own audiences, but actually more was realistically going on? I mean, that's the sense I get.
But I hope that's true. I think China may have had a hand here, which is good. The temperatures have come down, and that, I'm all for that. That's good. So, but it's a scary situation. And North Korea, it's a scary circumstance. Requires brilliant, and we've had a Republican administration and a Democratic administration, which preceded Trump, and they couldn't fix it.
Well, it's been an intractable.
And I think the one lesson, that one takeaway from the Trump-Obama meeting after Trump was president and before he assumed office, Obama spent a lot of time warning about the difficulty of North Korea.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm always sort of surprised by issues that the American public cares about and then issues that the American public appears not to care about. And one of the issues that I've been tracking for the last year is the role of Russia in America's democratic processes and in America's institutions. But there is a sizable percentage of the country that just really doesn't care. That says, we intervene in other people's elections and political processes all the time. Turnabout is fair game. It's not something to be excited about. I can't get my mind around that, but I'm wondering if you have any insights about sort of the American public's seemingly indifference, particularly out of the gate, to these reports from the intelligence community that Russia had intervened in the election.
Well, intervening in the election is sort of a complicated topic. There's been no real proof put on the table yet. I mean, I trust the process that's going through right now to find out what's going on. But I think that overall, Americans don't trust Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that overall, the Russians don't trust the United States. I was fortunate enough to do a lot of work in the Russia in the Soviet, as it began as the Soviet Union in 89, We worked there for the next 10 years while it became Russia. Mm-hmm. And we were able to kind of track. We did a series of national surveys with Russian pollsters. So I was able to witness what happened there. And I can tell you, in 1999, the Russian people were looking for a Putin. They didn't know the name, but they certainly knew what they wanted. They wanted a tough young guy to kind of manage their affairs. They have different values than we do. But I was there in 1988, and it was a tough place. I would love to go back now to see all that change that's taken place.
This survey that you did for the ADL was very comprehensive, looked at a lot of topics, and unfortunately we don't have time to get into nearly all of them or pretty much any of them. But one of the conclusions that struck me was this. Younger Americans under the age of 39 are remarkably free of prejudicial views. Mm. Talk about that. That is a pretty remarkable conclusion.
They are terrific.
Hopeful one, too.
It is a hopeful one. I always try to find the hope, you know, here.
Right. They are the least anti-Semitic cohort in the United States are people between the ages of 40 and 65.
The most. So the least are between 40 and 65?
Yes.
Least anti-Semitic?
Anti-Semitic.
Okay.
Okay, but specifically on issues of tolerance and race and things like that, younger Americans are better than that. But, you know, they're not quite as liberal or prejudice-free on the issue of anti-Semitism as the cohort ahead of them. Hmm. And I think that, I'm not sure why that is, I think that I have a lot of faith in younger Americans. I think that they will keep us moving in the right direction, so I don't mean to be too critical of them.
I have that same faith.
Well, it's an optimistic note. We're going to leave it there. John Martilla, Martilla Strategies, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Would like to know more about Story in the Public Square, including where you can find links to previous episodes, please visit us at pellcenter.org. And as always, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.